So as promised, I would like to ask to our speakers if they do have 3 minutes time each for if you want to make a statement, and then I would like to give the floor to our public. So I ask if one of you want to, please.
Yeah, thanks very much. Just a brief reaction to Luca Cefisi's remark on the top candidates and the procedure leading up to their appointment. I think it really was a parallel process that was going on in all political party families in Europe. And if you remember correctly, if I remember correctly, it was the European People's Party that fielded a that nominated a candidate in 2009, whereas the Socialists were not in a position to do so. Now, that was to some extent taken as a lesson, and then the Party of European Socialists did allow it develop a very elaborate procedure, actually a primary-like process, to nominate a candidate, you know, with exactly detailed rules of who would be eligible, and that there would have to be first a selection process of the candidates for the nomination, and then there would be a competitive process for different candidates for the nomination, and then there would be the nomination in the end. Well, in the end, we had only one socialist candidate for the nomination. That was Martin Schulz. You know, so you might say, okay, what was that elaborate procedure all for in the end? And in the European People's Party, there were controversial opinions about the question of nomination of top candidate. But if you look at the decisions of the party decision-making bodies, ever since October 2012 in Bucharest, it was completely clear that there would be a nomination of a top candidate. And in fact, there was a competitive vote at the very end in Dublin between Michel Barnier and Jean-Claude Juncker. You know, I think it really was a parallel development of all political families and not one party family going ahead and the others taking the good example of the European Socialists.
Sì, adesso non è particolarmente importante la ricostruzione. Pardon, non è particolarmente importante la ricostruzione dei meccanismi procedurali. All'interno del PSE vi è stato un processo molto elaborato e complesso perché abbiamo cercato di coinvolgere addirittura i nostri iscritti. Quindi questo è un valore. La complessità della partecipazione, credo di non doverlo spiegare in questa sede, è spesso il prezzo da pagare perché la partecipazione sia reale, altrimenti diventa partecipazione virtuale o semplice delega al leader. Noi abbiamo costruito un processo che è stato lento e complesso perché ha coinvolto davvero i nostri iscritti a grassroots level. Abbiamo anche costituito in questi anni un ampio sistema, i cosiddetti press activist, di partecipazione via internet che consente il cosiddetto top bottom up, cioè il fatto che il singolo iscritto, il singolo militante sia in grado in qualche maniera di ricevere direttamente informazioni, in qualche maniera di sentirsi più vicino al processo decisionale. Quindi parlando della questione della scarsa partecipazione politica, dello scarso livello di iscrizione, ecco, diciamo che proviamo, e questo sì comporta ancora una certa novecentesca pesantezza organizzativa e va bene così, proviamo a coinvolgere davvero chi ha la nostra tessera. Cos'altro aggiungere? Semplicemente che appunto dobbiamo vedere dopo queste elezioni che tipo di maggioranza si costruirà nel Parlamento europeo e ovviamente nella Commissione. Senza dubbio sarà più forte l'elemento di dialettica politica di quanto è avvenuto finora, cioè conterà di più non tanto essere tedeschi o italiani, conterà di più quale tipo di progetto politico si sposa effettivamente in maniera transnazionale.
Grazie, thank you very much. Please.
Thank you. I think for you in the room, it will be interesting to see not only what happens on election day, but particularly between the 25th of May, the evening of the 25th of May, when the first results will come in, and we know the balance of power inside the European Parliament, and the 27th of May, when, to my knowledge, there'll be a special European Council. So the council where Mr. Van Rompuy is the leading chairman. And particularly, and I hope, and this is like my question to maybe to the room and also to Mr. Freudenstein from the EPP, will the EPP leaders in their summit ahead of that, I would say, important European Council support their candidate? Because I think setting up, let's say, such an important decision so close to after the European elections, and the European Parliament itself has almost no possibilities in its new setting to discuss what they would like to see for the new European Commission, is I think, from a political science point of view, an interesting question that could be addressed.
Give the floor for a second to Ms. Elma, and then come for the answers.
Thank you. Yes, also on the question of the leading candidates, the Greens are not pretending that we're likely to be invited this time round to nominate the President of the European Commission, maybe next time, this time perhaps not. But we did think it was important to be at the table. We thought it was important to be in the debate, and being good Greens, we've nominated two lead candidates rather than one. But we did that by a process of open primaries, open to anyone over the age of 16 in any EU member state who was prepared just to sign a statement of support for green values, not to be a member of our party in particular. And that was the first time anyone had tried to do that, and it was not as successful as we'd hoped, but it was a worthwhile experiment, we thought, and it produced two very clear green candidates. And I think this is part of the ongoing debate that we're having as to how we have the instruments to create a debate at the EU level. One of the problems is that we have very great difficulty in publicising what's happening. There have already been two televised debates and there are two more to come. The broadcast media are very productive in some of their main channels. They tend to put them onto their specialist parliamentary channels. So in the UK, the BBC is not showing this on their main channel, they're showing it on an obscure channel which nobody could get hold of. So we have a real problem in trying to generate sufficient media coverage to enable the public to understand that this debate is going on. So I think, again, this is something which over the next 5 years, hopefully we will develop further, but this time around it's only a partial success. And the question just proposed is really a vital one, which is what decision the Council will propose for the presidency of the Commission, and more importantly, how the Parliament will react. At the moment, parliamentary groups, all of us and the others, are saying that we need to respect the outcome of the vote, and the candidate therefore needs to be someone who can command a majority inside the Parliament. I think if the Council presents or proposes a candidate for the Commission presidency which does not follow those rules, there will be uproar in Parliament. And if there is not, then the Parliament is really a waste of time.
So, Mr. President, I think there is a question for you.
Well, will the EPP leaders support their candidate at the pre-summit on the 27th? It's indeed the billion-dollar question, but my answer is, if it's their candidate that is considered the winner of the elections, then yes, okay. They will. I think the political dynamics, which is developing as we speak in this campaign, will make it highly probable that indeed, the winner of the elections will be considered the the right man or woman to be proposed for Commission President. Now, will we know by the 27th of May who won the election in the sense of became the strongest political group? Again, my answer is probably yes, but there's no guarantee, because we'll have a number of small parties that are joining the European Parliament for the first time that will still have to make up their minds which group they'll join. But my guess is this will probably not alter the balance between the two biggest political families, i.e. the Socialists and the European People's Party. There is also, of course, the question whether some minor or even larger national delegations will actually leave one of these two big political families. Again, it's not probable, but it can't be completely excluded. But again, I think these decisions will not have been taken by 27th of May. So my guess is there's a very high interest among all the mainstream, if I may say so, mainstream groups in the European Parliament to actually declare someone the winner, declare a party the winner of the election, and the others might then rally behind that party with its candidate. And then there will be, of course, a process, a more or less complex process of communication and negotiation with the Council, in which Herman Van Rompuy is probably going to play the lead role as the go-between, the facilitator. I mean, some people actually compare it to Belgian politics with the informateur and the formateur and explorateur, and they have these different roles. But the gist of it is to say that Van Rompuy will probably do some shuttle diplomacy between the Council and the presidents of the group in the European Parliament, and these will be the same presidents as now because the new groups haven't constituted themselves yet. So you know, there'll be some shuttle diplomacy, and my guess is the Council will actually not propose a different person from the person that looks like getting a majority in the European Parliament. That's as much as I can say at this point in time. But to give a short answer to the question, will EPP leaders support their candidate, if it is their candidate that's considered the winner? Yes, they will.
Thank you very much. I would like to know if there's someone in the audience that wishes to I ask you to state brief questions, 1 minute, 2 minutes, not interventions, but questions. And please introduce yourself to the public. Thank you.
Thank you. My name is Gaetano De Venuto. I'm a secretary of the Union of the European Federalist Local Section of PEGUA. In Italian, it's Movimento Federalista Europeo. And I have two questions for both the representatives. The first one is, are you in favor of the change of the name of the party into a single name, which is the same wherever in Europe, so-called EPP / D stands for Deutschland, E stands for Italy, and so on, in order to let recognize to people wherever they are and what the European political family is, I hope party is. Second question is, are you in favor of a rule which oblige a percentage of candidates from other European countries instead of that one which is in the electoral seat? Thank you.
Shall I ask? There was another hand raised. The third row. I collect three questions and then proceed to the answers.
Yes, my name is Maria Romana Allegri. I come from Sapienza University of Rome. And I would like to know from the representative of political parties, well, I have a couple of questions. The first one is about the debate about the candidate for the presidency of the Commission. Mr. Emmott said before that there is a problem of media coverage, so that people, common people, normally is not aware of the on how this debate is going on. But I think that there is also a problem of engagement of national political parties, at least the Italian ones, who actually don't do much to underline their belonging to a political, a European political family, and their support to a specific candidate. So I would like a comment from you to that point. And the second one is I would like to know your opinion about the new regulation on the statute of political parties, which has been recently approved, and why it is they decided that it will be effective only since 2017. Don't you think it's a sign of a sort of a weakness of the political will to reinforce European political parties? Thank you.
Okay. Dario Velo Hause. Une demande à mon ami Feuerstein en particulier. Parce que j'ai vu une petite contradiction, peut-être, dans votre speech. C'est-à-dire, vous avez parfaitement raison à dire que le processus de construction européenne a été original et voilà le problème. C'est-à-dire, on a fait un transfert des pouvoirs à un processus, non à un État, déjà constitué. Et ça veut dire que toutes les fois qu'on a fait un transfert des pouvoirs, on a eu des problèmes de comprendre, d'établir de nouvelles règles, de changer la Constitution, etc. Second point, au contraire, vous avez dit que maintenant, il faut changer les règles pour avoir développement, c'est-à-dire changer les schémas classiques de transfert des pouvoirs dans un sens, comment dire, de constitution matérielle avant d'avoir la constitution formelle. Vous avez dit au contraire que maintenant il faut parler de constitution formelle avant de faire une constitution matérielle nouvelle. L'union économique a commencé, sans discuter l'union économique. C'est-à-dire qu'on a déjà commencé à changer les règles, à faire une nouvelle constitution matérielle avant d'établir un accord parfait sur l'union économique. Exemple empirique. Les fédéralistes traditionnels parlent des Eurobonds, c'est-à-dire de la capacité de la Commission d'avoir la capacité d'obtenir des ressources de l'économie, de la société pour financer des politiques. Et on a, au contraire, Draghi qui offre 1000 milliards à l'économie européenne. Non demande 1000 milliards, mais offre des ressources créées par le processus, créées par la Banque Centrale Européenne dans ce exemple. Ça veut dire changer complètement les règles. Ça veut dire avoir une capacité déjà concrète de financer les développements qui n'est pas compris, parce qu'elle est nouvelle. C'est une chose qu'on a déjà vue, parce que la Banque Centrale Européenne a déjà donné plus de 1000 milliards pour surmonter la crise financière. Maintenant, offre 1000 milliards pour relancer le développement et l'occupation. On parle de l'opération en Italie de notre gouvernement de 5 milliards, non, qui est très importante, et on ne comprend pas une opération pareille. Alors, ça veut dire quel est le contenu des programmes des partis européens vis-à-vis de ces changements historiques. Si les journaux, si l'opinion publique ne parle pas de cette révolution qui est en train de se développer, les partis politiques européens ont conscience du changement, sont en même de changer, comment dire, la capacité de gouverner ce type d'innovation radicale, constitutionnelle, économique, sociale, qui est le rapport entre notre société et les institutions européennes. Merci.
First round of answers. I give the floor to each one of our speakers because I think that there are questions that concern starting from with the same order. So, Mr. Franz, go.
Thanks. Well, about the questions asked by Mr. Divenuto, is that right? The name harmonization is a nice idea, but it would never get past our member parties. Now, call me a coward, but I would call it realistic. You see, for that to happen, for the CDU in Germany to rename itself into Europäische Volkspartei / Deutschland, would then require them either to rename themselves during the regional, local, national elections as well, or to actually create terrible confusion. I think our Spanish and Austrian colleagues have a fairly easy job at this. You know, by the way, these are the two countries where the European People's Party is actually clearly recognized as the center-right party. You know why? Because the Österreichische Volkspartei and Europäische Volkspartei is it's exactly the same name, only with a different adjective. And the Partido Popular Español, Partido Popular Europeo, is logically the same political family. No, unfortunately, in most member states, that doesn't work. So I really don't see any chance of coming to this state in which you would have a different name for the party in the European election and a different name for the party in the national election and still expect voters to make that that nexus. On the room to have a minimum of non-native candidates, yes, it's something we should think about, and it should never be something that is imposed from the top on the European parties. Every party should decide that for themselves. Now, on the party statute, why only 2017? I have no idea, frankly speaking. If it was for me, it could be introduced tomorrow. But such is the nature, I think, of European politics that things take time. Now, to Professor Velo's indeed very interesting remarks. Now, we could have a seminar on this question. I absolutely agree that treaty changes have been made in recent years without the usual paraphernalia of treaty change. You know, there was no convention, there was no referenda on these questions, but the treaties have been substantially changed. For me, the decisive point in this one... Vous préférez que je parle français? Okay. The decisive point on these changes is, are we having economic governance at the EU level, or are we having an economic government? And here, the answer is clear, we have more governance, but we do not have an economic government. Much to the chagrin of many people who would like to see a European economics minister and a European finance minister. But I'm afraid that, on that question, we are far from a consensus on the member states, and I personally am not convinced that we do need a European economic government or any European government, at least not in the form of the European Commission taking on the function of the government. But if and when the member states do agree that there is no alternative, they will take that course, absolutely. But it's like with the Eurobonds. Some people believe that it's the right thing to have now or in the near future to have a timeline for getting to Eurobonds, and other people believe, and I think they have some rational arguments, to believe that it would actually be detrimental to the reform process and to getting to more competitiveness in the European Union if we decided on Eurobonds right now. So, that is about the spectrum of the whole debate in Europe, and in the big political families, it would be very, very difficult, at least for my political family, to come to a consensus that would point to a sursaut fédéraliste, a big jump, a big leap forward in a federalist direction at this point in time. But let me just make one last remark. No, it's really important. Rather than mechanistic solutions, I think we will regain the trust, or begin to regain the trust of the citizens here through success, not through adopting this or that institutional solution on the EU level. If we manage to get the European Union back to competitiveness and sustainable growth, and sustainability includes fiscal sustainability. You know, it's such a great thing that the Greens have introduced the principle of sustainability. But I think that sustainability has to be understood in a holistic sense, to use another word from the Green universe. And this holistic sense includes finance. You cannot spend money that you don't have, or that you don't even know when you're going to earn it. And that's a very, very simple truth, which I'm afraid has been disregarded by all kinds of political families in Europe over the last 50 years. And I think we're beginning to learn that that does not work. And that's sustainability, as I understand it, plus the climate change, of course. So, you know, it's success that will breed the new progress in European integration, and not first and foremost mechanistic solutions.
Yes, Luca.
Yeah, on the, so to speak, harmonization of political parties in Europe, well, there is a recommendation. Yeah, I was forgetting the microphone. There is a recommendation from the European Commission and one from the Parliament. And actually, no national countries has adopted them. The recommendations are just on the electoral process. Commission and European Parliament have stated that the electoral law in national countries should, for instance, let the European membership of the different lists visible by the voter on the ballot. But you will not find it nowhere in Europe. There should be a joint effort, which has not been achieved, to make those recommendations to accept, to really make those recommendations feasible and make them functioning. This has not been done. There are so many recommendations, as they are not binding, at the end of the day, no one really make them practical. But that should be a good example. There has been as well an ordine del giorno in the Italian Parliament, yes, let's adopt this recommendation from Europe, let's make the European parties visible on the scheda elettorale, but end of the day, you will not find this. We have done this right in PSA, on our symbol on the ballot, also there is also the name of Verhofstadt by the Italian liberals, I think. So there is some update, but this has not been organized. Generally speaking, this is a process. Yes, I don't know if 2017 is far away, not far away. It's a process. The important thing is that all the process is leading somewhere. And yeah, it's true that that's not mechanical, that's not bureaucratical, that's mainly a matter of political will, political decision. Aggiungerei, per una discussione italo-italiana, che noi abbiamo avuto sempre in Italia questa frizione fra identità nazionale, politica nazionale ed europeismo, mai ben risolta. Io sono abbastanza vecchio, ricordarmi negli anni 70 che il tema della discussione della sinistra italiana era la diversità della sinistra italiana, che era il tema chiave, no? L'eurocomunismo, no? Mille elementi per sostenere che l'Italia era diversa e doveva essere diversa rispetto a un, per carità, forzato, perché molto forzato, è stato a un, comunque a un, diciamo così, a un modello europeo occidentale. In quel momento la discussione era appunto sinistra italiana doveva essere socialdemocratica o doveva essere diversa. Personalmente ritengo che questa discussione sulla sinistra italiana, nella sinistra italiana, sia stata disastrosa. Praticamente la stiamo concludendo adesso. Se negli anni 70 si diceva che la sinistra italiana doveva essere socialdemocratica come in Germania, Scandinavia, Francia eccetera, secondo me non avremmo perso 30 anni nella sinistra italiana. Questo brutalmente quello che penso io, insomma. Ma credo che, diciamo così, per quel poco niente che serva, i fatti degli ultimi 30 anni in qualche maniera confermino questa opinione. Abbiamo poi avuto un'anomalia della destra italiana spaventosa, cioè abbiamo avuto una destra fatta di Berlusconi più leghisti più ex fascisti, cioè la cosa meno omologabile all'Europa, meno spendibile all'Europa che ci fosse. Anche questa adesso con fatica. Il problema non è normalizzare l'Italia a una presunta Europa astratta, ovviamente, però è estremamente provinciale ritenere, diciamola così, che come si mangia dalla mamma non si mangia da nessuna parte. Esiste obiettivamente una serie di esperienze europee traducibili in italiano che poi non sono tanto in ideologie, sono in soluzioni politiche. Penso al welfare state, no? In Italia abbiamo sempre avuto un welfare state anomalo e parziale, ecco. Ci sono una serie di esperienze europee che vanno tradotte in italiano. L'Italia va non omologata, ma va come dire, messa meglio in connessione. E sicuramente la diversità italiana è stata in questi anni un problema, non un'opportunità, non una risorsa. Questo ovviamente si applica poi al tema di queste domande a cui sto cercando di rispondere, perché la diversità italiana fa sì poi che sulla scheda elettorale, che nei messaggi politici, per forza vi è questa questione sempre molto italo-italiana, perché vi è una intraducibilità. Ma guardate, questo è un problema che anche nella discussione accademica lo vedete, guardate che la lingua italiana è una lingua molto ricca, ma quando un ragionamento in italiano non riuscite a tradurlo bene in inglese, che è una lingua più povera, più standard, guardate che c'è un problema nel ragionamento italiano, eh? Non so se mi spiego, vuol dire che è troppo barocco, troppo balanzonesco. Una certa semplificazione e razionalizzazione del discorso politico italiano è sicuramente ancora necessaria.
On, like, from our perspective on this question from the European Liberal Democrats, on the name, unfortunately in too many countries we have too many political parties which are member of a political party, which is I think the case in Italy, and there are a number of other countries. Already making these political parties within the national context talking to each other, sometimes they are within a government coalition, but sometimes there also could be opponents. Which of the parties would take the name of the European Liberal Democrat? Big question mark. So my answer to this would, no, I would not be in favor of this, at least not at this stage. But what I could encourage, and in fact some of our member parties put this into practice, is the other question asked by the lady, a clear distinction so that you can understand that, for example, my political party in the Netherlands, where I come from, is part of the European Liberal family. And so if you vote for this party, there, those MEPs will sit in the Liberal group in the European Parliament. I think that's probably a better let's say, solution to the question, because in our case, as you have more parties, this gives all of the parties the opportunity to make their choice. On the candidates' question from other European countries, I don't think this is something that we, either from the EU or the European political parties, have to decide for our member parties. I think, in fact, some of our member parties, whenever they see an opportunity, and you must know, a political party is an organization that in fact wants to gain power with candidates. And so if you have a candidate from, let's say, another country with which you believe you can actually convince voters to vote for your party, surely you would field a candidate from another party. I think Daniel Cohn-Bendit from the Greens is probably one of the best examples in this respect. Well-respected politician with support both in France and in Germany. So that's I would say the best example. I think there was once a Finnish candidate candidating for the French center-right political party, and then being member of the EPP group a few parliaments ago, a race driver. So that's something which really I think that could be a better opportunity. On a statute, yes, I don't have a clear answer either why it's only in 2.5-3 years and not already now. From our perspective, probably it takes a bit of time, and the council always takes its decisions and has always considerations why it doesn't want to implement it right now. That's my answer.
Thank you. Yes, I agree with my colleagues that I think trying to impose a standardised name just wouldn't work, and for the reasons that you've heard. But I do think the idea that the family logo should be added to the ballot paper would be a move forward. The problem again is that we don't have a common EU electoral law, so there are plenty of different sets of regulations applying each of 28 member states. I think it is possible in the UK to put those sort of logos and labels on there, but I'm not sure exactly how that works. And again, I agree with trying to impose a quota, if you like, of the nationalities on the list is not a good solution, it's not a democratic solution. But I would prefer to see the idea that some seats are reserved as a transnational list, although the mechanism where people would be elected, I think the idea is 25 to 30 as an experiment. Seats would be allocated for these transnational votes, and so electors would be able to see that there were other countries involved and there were people outside the country that's coming. The question why national parties are not really pushing the lead candidate debate, some perhaps are doing more than others, but I think part of the problem is that it's not an election. I can't vote for Mr. Juncker or Mr. Verhofstadt or even my own Greenhouse. I have to live in the countries where they're studied. So there is no direct election for the post of the European Commission president. So that's kind of an odd story to tell people, that we're having this contest. But in some ways it's a private internal contest and not a public democratic contest. So until such time as the European Commission President and indeed the European Council President are elected directly, we don't really have proper participative democracy. I think that's one of the reasons that people find it hard to tell a story and promote this situation. But very much those of us who are on the inside, I think it's exciting and want to argue about how it's going to work. The rest of the population, I suspect, is totally unmoved at this stage by this issue. Legal status for 2017, like everybody else, I don't know the answer. And you probably gauge from that it's not top of our list for things to worry about, so it will happen in due course. Just briefly on treaty changes, one of the issues we haven't talked about, and it's really the elephant in the room that everyone's ignoring, is what we're going to do about Eurozone. The Eurozone is on the track towards deeper integration. And we probably require treaty change in order to implement that. How is that going to be managed and exercised? What will be the role of the non-Euro member currency for member states? Which my country is one. How will they be built into the decision-making process? Or will there be a second circle of second-class EU membership? Those questions have been asked and not asked. And there's been talk inside the Parliament of setting up a separate parliamentary group for Eurozone and other members only. That seems not to be very popular, but it's still on the table. It's very unclear how this is going to develop.
other questions? So, please. Ask you to introduce yourself and then pose a question.
Sure. Good morning, everybody. I'm Lucia Saccone, school teacher, secondary school teacher, and my question is for all our guests. You all seem to agree upon the fact that citizens are not participating enough. So this is what lacks at the moment. My question is, what have political parties been doing on this ground? And I mean something new, apart from leaflet, phone calls, TV coverage, and what the media offer. Something really up to the point, making people able to communicate effectively directly with politicians. Of course, we know very well that nowadays everybody can rush up to us and every prospective candidate or candidate already elected are able to come up to us and will meet us in any case, in any moment, wherever, whatever, whenever. But what next? What's before, what's during? I feel that this is what is lacking, honestly. There is a great difficulty in keeping contact with real citizens. So I would like a pragmatic answer. What has been done apart from that is done all the time? TV coverage, leaflets, and maybe importuning phone calls. Thanks.
Thank you.
I am Alice, a student of political science, international relations, and human rights. I would like to ask our guest, what kind of role European institution, European Parliament, European Commission, and Committee of Region would play in the Europe after the reform? All of you underline the need of a political reform in order to grant more democracy in European Union, but it's not clear what kind of power will have European Parliament, European Commission, for example, and other institutions. I know the Committee of Region is a role of, as a representative of other reality that is not state, not international reality, but at the same time important. Thank you.
Are there other questions? So we'll ask, I will ask again to our panelists if they want to comment and answer to this question. Exactly. As there are general questions regarding all the panels, so please.
Okay. Well, yes, as to the citizens' participation, I think all parties, both the national parties and the European level parties, have been making efforts to increase that. And I think Stephen just gave a beautiful example of the e-primary of the Greens for their candidate, only that. I think leading politicians of the Greens before that primary said, well, 100,000 participation is the minimum to declare a success. It ended up 23,000, which is still good, but, I think it's probably a model to be considered for the future, but it will take an awfully long time. And we haven't found the magic formula, how to get citizens more involved. The EPP did a very elaborate website, Up to Youth, where youngsters could make proposals as to youth unemployment and education. Those were the two issues they actually focused on. And this was then worked into the priorities of the EPP group for the next 5 years in the European Parliament. There are all kinds of methods to increase citizens' participation, but in the end, I think we always end up in this kind of vicious circle between European institutions, media, and national politics, where it's very, very difficult to spot the one element which has to be worked on or improved in order to get participation higher. I think we're all going to be really happy and breathe a sigh of relief if the turnout of the turnout in the European elections this time will at least stabilize. and remain on the same level of around 43% after the European elections, that would already be a huge success. Otherwise, I can only encourage all the citizens to get involved with the respective national parties that are members of the European party family. And as to the role of the institutions after political reform, well, that would really take a lot of time to outline
a program. Course.
That's another conference in this beautiful town.
Thank you.
Allora, Alice, giusto? Ora, credo che abbiamo un'ambiguità profonda delle istituzioni europee, questo è il punto, che è estremamente sui generis la costruzione dell'Unione Europea. E poiché in gran parte i trattati devono ancora trovare la loro applicazione, quindi la loro messa in strada, solo la storia ci dirà come funzionerà. Noi non possiamo sapere molte delle cose che sono state messe su carta sul medio e lungo periodo come funzioneranno finché non vedremo come funziona. Vi è insomma un divario tra la formalità giuridica e la sua realizzazione pratica, che è tutto, come dire, la croce edilizia non solo dello studio ma anche dell'esperienza storica. Vedremo, insomma, dobbiamo vedere cosa succederà, e qui aggiungo un'opinione che è più personale, nel senso che non è nemmeno l'intera famiglia del socialismo europeo, perché su questo non c'è consenso. Io ritengo, da socialista italiano, che vi sia la necessità di un'Europa federale. Messo in maniera semplicistica al massimo, ma quando gli americani hanno visto che l'economia europea non solo stava tracollando in questi anni, ma stava tirando sotto anche l'economia mondiale, hanno telefonato dicendo: ma cosa fa la vostra banca centrale? Perché non fa come la Federal Reserve, non sostiene le obbligazioni europee sul mercato finanziario, non combatte la speculazione. Gli è stato risposto: beh, ma la Banca Centrale Europea mica funziona come la banca di uno Stato federale, è un'altra istituzione diversa, ha limiti diversi. E con orrore gli americani hanno scoperto una cosa che in realtà dovevano sapere, cioè che l'Unione Europea non è uno Stato federale, non c'è un tesoro, non c'è un fisco comune. È ovvio che in questa situazione estremamente sui generis, che ha ragioni storiche ma anche ragioni ideologiche, l'Europa è costruita così perché vi è stata una predominanza di un'ideologia di tipo conservatore, di tipo neoliberale, neoliberista, che ha detto: facciamo solo politiche monetarie, il resto non serve. È una cosa così sbagliata che nemmeno la patria del capitalismo degli Stati Uniti pensano così. Si è pensato così in Europa e ne paghiamo il prezzo. Quindi credo di ho risposto in maniera forse troppo articolata anche la tua domanda, che era, se vogliamo, più semplice, ma ritengo che la questione sia: come funzioneranno le riforme delle istituzioni europee? Questo lo vedremo dopo, ma quello che è certo è che siamo ancora, io credo, in una fase intermedia, in una fase storicamente intermedia. Poi dovranno succedere nuove riforme, nuovi eventi politici, perché la Costituzione europea, così com'è, io credo che non possa reggere sul lungo periodo. Questo ovviamente non per derivare che l'Europa non serve, ma per derivare che l'Europa dovrà essere ancora ulteriormente riformata. Altra croce edilizia, la partecipazione dei cittadini ai partiti, eccetera. Signora professoressa, siamo franchi. Sono al tempi di Mani Pulite, sono 20 anni che in questo paese si tira merda sui partiti politici. Io potrei anche dirle sorridendo: ma cosa volete da noi? Siamo l'istituzione più screditata che c'è in Italia, facciamo quello che possiamo. Fuori battuta e fuori amarezza, io credo che ci sia una dimensione di lotta politica che a un certo punto ha previsto che una serie di soggetti della nostra società, finanziari, economici, mediatici, hanno ritenuto che i partiti politici fossero un peso. e quindi andavano screditati e bisognava dire alla gente che si poteva fare senza, per, non per i politici di professione, ma per decine di migliaia di normali cittadini che dal dopoguerra ad oggi hanno dedicato alla militanza politica il loro tempo libero, i loro soldi, no? Questi anni sono stati anni di profonda umiliazione. Anche la teoria della casta, no? Per cui chi è in un partito politico appartiene a una casta, ma l'esperienza italiana non era questa. L'esperienza italiana era di partiti di profondamente di massa, dove era il condominio per condominio, cioè, ero bambino in classe, voglio dire, i bambini sapevano che i loro genitori, chi era liberale, chi era democristiano, chi era comunista, chi era socialista. C'è stato un attacco, voglio dire, violentissimo per i politici, stanchi, corrotti, quello che vuoi tu, non hanno retto. Però questo attacco per i politici è stato un attacco alla democrazia. E adesso noi vediamo che abbiamo dei politici fortemente verticalizzati, qui c'è un altro elemento, ed è, sono i cambiamenti sociali di questi anni. Mio padre, che era un militante politico, lavorava, staccava dal lavoro, aveva tempo per questo, come dire, questo terzo spazio che non è la vita privata e non è la vita professionale. C'era questo tempo, negli anni... È notizia recente che in Occidente si lavora circa 28 giorni in più adesso rispetto a 30 anni fa, lungo l'anno. C'era più spazio per l'attività sociale, per l'attività politica. Questo spazio si è ridotto, perché una serie di meccanismi economici e sociali perversi tolgono spazio alla socialità di ogni tipo, anche alla militanza. Allora, questo combinato disposto di discredito dei partiti politici, cambiamenti sociali in peggio, per cui tu hai sempre meno tempo libero dal lunedì al venerdì, perché il lavoro è diventato liquido, no? La mail, il cellulare, tu lavori fino a notte, rispondi alle mail di notte, no? Sul lavoro, cioè, questa è un'esperienza comune, insomma. Sabato e la domenica, dopo aver prodotto fino a venerdì, sabato e domenica si consuma, cioè si va in weekend, si va all'IKEA, eccetera, è un meccanismo che toglie spazio alla società. Assolutamente. Siamo tutti immersi in questo meccanismo, che non è un meccanismo neutro, è un meccanismo che va valutato e giudicato e anche combattuto. Al tempo stesso si è detto che i politici non servono, sono ferri vecchi, Ale, contatto diretto, mediatico, no, Berlusconi scende in campo, contatto diretto. Clicchiamo, parliamo col web, anche un grillo, contatto diretto. Questo modello del contatto diretto, voi me lo insegnate perché lo studiate, è un modello che, per quanto sia affascinante, ha una serie di aspetti che possono essere micidiali. Noi vediamo che in generale tutti i cosiddetti corpi intermedi sono sempre meno attivi. È positivo, è negativo, questo però, ecco, questo dovete dirvelo voi a me. C'è speranza per i corpi intermedi, quelli che una volta organizzavano il consenso e la partecipazione? Io credo che debba essercene, perché non credo che il contatto mediatico sostituisca la partecipazione diretta. Per infatti sono in un partito politico. Ho l'impressione che la crisi dei partiti politici sia un aspetto generale di una crisi della democrazia, che va presa sul serio, che non va solo messa in termini moralistici, insomma. Il modello sorto fra il 700 e 800, per cui i saggi si riuniscono in un senato, no? Più o meno con le loro parrucche, eccetera, eccetera, dibattono per giorni e poi fanno una legge, è sicuramente superato da meccanismi, non voglio essere marxista, ma insomma, da meccanismi della struttura economica che impediscono efficacia alla tradizionale democrazia rappresentativa. In questo problema, che è anche un dramma, siamo tutti immersi. Le soluzioni semplici. Concludo. Le soluzioni semplici, e mi scuso se mi sono fatto prendere, le soluzioni semplici non sono necessariamente le soluzioni migliori. Mi scuso. No,
grazie. Please, yeah.
The two questions. Thank you for the question on the institutions, of the European institutions. I would like to make. Two observations on this, on two particular institutions, because you mentioned one of them, of which I think is indeed is a relevant topic. Nobody questions the European, well,
some people question the European Parliament, but let's say from the main EU institutions, there's, let's say, not a big question mark. Nobody questions the European Council, nobody questions the European Commission, but there are definitely two big question marks with the Committee of the Regions, is one of them. The other one is the European Economic and Social Committee, and I would like particularly like to address this one, because Professor Masia mentioned it at the start of today's session. The big interest that especially lobby organizations, companies, big companies at the EU level have in Brussels towards the European institutions, trying to set, or let's say influence, the agenda setting. This is indeed true, and this is something which has always existed, but in recent times you can clearly see that big companies, corporations, put a lot of money into this in setting, in influencing the agenda. If in addition, and now comes my, let's say, my view on and also a party view on a European Economic and Social Committee, if in addition you have a publicly funded institute with vested interests of Europe's companies and trade unions, just to simplify, influencing the European agenda, you can really question whether that is well spent EU money. On the question of the Committee of the Regions, there we have, let's say, a more open approach. There we do see an advantage of having a Committee of the Regions, but there's, like, again, there's something which needs to be added. Until recently, the Committee of the Regions was making many opinions, they call them opinions, not reports like in European Parliament, and they tabled them towards the European Commission particularly, and also to the European Parliament. I spoke to many parliamentarians, and in most cases what happened was, well, when it was still on paper, it immediately went into the dustbin. Nowadays, as far as I know, and what I hear from both my colleagues inside the Committee of the Regions and in the European Parliament, there is a more constructive cooperation, and indeed, because the EU, with its multi-level governance, it is important that also local and regional authorities have the possibility to make an impact on EU decision making. To answer the question on new ways of engaging with citizens and connecting them to activities of the political parties and having the possibility to basically get your message to politicians, I would give two examples. One at the EU level, done by us as the ALDE party, and one by one of our member parties, being done this campaign. When we as ALDE party were like busy drafting our manifesto, in parallel, we thought, why not try out some of the ideas that we want to include in our manifesto with particularly young people. So what we did, we called it an idea challenge on Facebook. The specific topic was youth entrepreneurship, and I wouldn't say it was a big success, but still a few hundred young people participated. They came up with ideas on how to promote youth entrepreneurship, how to promote chances for young people in economic life and in business. And of course, like what you like, you could ask, like what was, let's say, the connection, and how was it, let's say, beneficial for individuals? In fact, the, let's say, the best participants, those who gained the most points, it was like a kind of game, they could win a video chat with the Liberal Commissioner Nelly Kroes for the digital agenda. So in fact, let's say the five best candidates could present their idea to a top level European politician. And it's maybe a small initiative, but I think it's again one of the examples of where we try to improve connections between individual citizens and EU level politics. From a member party level, our Austrian political party is a fairly new political party, and they try to have new ways of involving citizens. And for example, during these European Parliament elections, they basically push all their candidates for the European Parliament to participate in what they call living room meetings. So in somebody's home, you invite your neighbors or your family, and there's a candidate from the political party, and so they can ask questions. It's small, of course. It's something for 15, 20 people maximum at a time. But again, it is a possibility to have a more direct contact with candidates towards the European Parliament.
Thank you, Dan.
Thank you.
Thank you. I think that we have only 3-4 minutes.
Yeah. So,
I'm sorry to ask it to be very, very simple. Thank you.
Very, very briefly, I think on citizens' participation, it's a permanent challenge, and I don't think any of us have magic answers. I think the internet is clearly the instrument which cuts across national borders, which enables us to try and talk to people without a filter or without any intermediaries. And so I think e-campaigning is going to be the instrument of the future, if it's not going to be the instrument of today. We, like others, I think, are still trying to work out what the best use to make of social networks and other online tools. But it seems to me that it's a cost-effective and direct way of communicating with citizens. If they want to communicate with us, that's a two-way process. So it doesn't always work if we keep insisting that we want to talk to people who don't want to talk to us. I think things like the European Citizens Initiative, which has been going now for 2 or 3 years, also are a way of engaging people directly in policy making or at least in policy proposals. It gives a feeling that they have some access which otherwise they would feel they were denied. On political reform, I proposed a little while ago to my party that we should have a policy of abolishing the Committee of the Regions and the Economic and Social Committee, and I was screamed at and howled down and told it wasn't possible to do that, performing very, very valuable functions. I'm still not persuaded what those functions are. I think they're useful talking shops, but I share the view that we just heard that in terms of publicly funded institutions, we need to know a lot more what their role should be, or they should be reformed, and if necessary, abolished.
Thank you very much. I do not have any closing remarks, but I would like to ask Professor Marshall to join us here, just because in order to thank from our association or our guests, we'd like to present.
We have a present.
A very small present for our association and University of Padua, to our distinguished speakers and guests, even the one that is missing now.
He's coming back, I hope.
I think he will come back. Thank you very much. Just a final word. I heard someone say that we are in a deep euro crisis, and the United States are calling us because they are very worried about us. Please, if it happens again, please recall to the United States that the euro is a very solid currency, and maybe the crisis is elsewhere, and we are the ones that are trying to get them out of the crisis. So, thank you very much for being with us. And thank you to the audience. Thanks to the audience for being our guest today. And I now
we have a break.
Break, exactly. And then we start again at 2:30.
Half past two.
Same place.